You know that feeling when you're about to score 30% off, but they want your number? Ugh. Give them your Line 2 number instead. It's a second line on your phone, perfect for nabbing promo codes without inviting spam to your party. Sign up for every discount under the sun, then block the junk texts that follow. You get all the perks, but none of the spammy baggage. More codes, less chaos. Visit line2.com/audio or download Line 2 in the App Store and get your shopping sidekick today. Because the only thing blowing up your phone should be good deals.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast on Tuesday, the 19th of May, 2019. On the podcast today, I have Chris Jeffries, Chief Executive Officer of Dev Clever Holdings, DEV is ticker there, and Chris discusses the potential of the new virtual reality careers guidance experience, Victor, which went live at the end of March. Also on the podcast, Alan Green, CEO of Brand Communications, talks about BidStack, EveSleep, and Bluebird Merchant Ventures. Plus, Darren Sinden, market analyst at Pepperstone Limited, talks about US-China trade talks seemingly in tatters at the moment, the US equity sell-off, declining earnings expectations into Q2, Vodafone dividend cut, and the UK employment data. And as always, I have two lists for you, the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours, and the top five most liked RNSs too. By the way, you can see top 10 versions of both these lists at voxmarkets.co.uk, where you'll also see lots of other content. Stuff in there from Malky, from Zach. There's interviews with Charlie Morris, and there's articles on the SP Morning View. China hits back at Seoul, US rare earth miner, Physiomics. There's lots of content there. Check it out, voxmarkets.co.uk. By the way, if you use the Vox Markets app on your phone, and it's free to use, of course, doesn't cost you a penny. But if you get value from it, just return that favour, please, and just give us a nice review at the Apple Store or Android Store. Thanks very much.
Tired of using different sites to research companies? Vox Markets aggregates key financial details, pricing data, and company news into one place. Find out more at voxmarkets.co.uk/app.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Chris Jeffries, Chief Executive Officer of Dev Clever Holdings. DEV is the ticker there. Chris, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Hi, Justin. How are you again?
Yeah, I'm good. And I assume you're keeping busy. And I don't know how long it's been now. I know time flies. We're still relatively new to the stock market, aren't you? So for people not sort of familiar with the business, Chris, can you summarise what is Dev Clever Holdings all about, please?
So we're an innovation business in technology. So we're a software development company. We are an existing business which have been trading for 5 years. And during that period, we've been developing our own proprietary software and immersive experiences, to which point in January this year, we then listed the company with a view to offer our productized solutions in three primary channels, which are Engage, where we help brands and retailers and merchants drive customer activations and shopper incentives. We experience, where we produce immersive customer and gaming experiences, and Educate, where we produce immersive and intuitive recruitment platforms for careers.
Yeah.
The education sector.
And that's what we're going to sort of major on today, sort of break it down a bit. So the Educate part, and I know you have sort of Victor, who's a virtual interactive training sort of little character there. So take us through how it works, the size of the market, and all that stuff. Just give us a brief overview, if you could, there, Chris.
Well, so the careers market is a huge issue across the world, not just the UK, although the UK is where Dev Clever is focusing on it currently. Mm-hmm. And effectively, it's been identified by the government that we are not engaging young people in careers information at school from the age of 12 upwards. So Victor has been developed in collaboration both with schools, colleges, training providers, apprenticeship providers over the last 4 years. And it is an application which uses virtual reality to deliver careers information at a young age to get that young person engaged in what their future can be. And And Victor, who is a virtual interactive careers training and apprenticeship robot, actually supports the delivery of that careers information at schools. And it supports a government mandate, which came into effect this year, where schools have to meet a certain benchmark criteria called the Gatsby 8 benchmarks. Mm-hmm. And it's a mechanism for schools to get, so your school children to get more engaged in their careers, so that they can then look at their future in more detail and make more informed decisions about where they're going to take their next step to from school, whether it's going to go into further education or are they going to go into an apprenticeship or a training provider. And it's all about helping the national reformed skills program to reduce the skills gap, which is the government estimate to cost the UK taxpayer £90 billion sterling per year by 2024.
Yeah, wow. And so you launched, Victor, the back end of March there. How is it going?
It's been tremendous, actually. It's, we've been introducing it to schools, mainly across the Midlands, because that's where our head office is based. And every, more than 50% of all the schools that we've already been out and met and spoke to have already signed up to Victor, and we've been introducing that to them and their students over the past couple of weeks. In terms of the adoption of it, it's way beyond our expectations. We are already in quite advanced talks with careers funding initiatives to subsidise the cost of Victor in the actual school sector, which is going to lead to a huge accelerated growth process that we're going through right now to get Victor out into that marketplace. And I think what has been so encouraging about it is not only the schools that have really bought into the concept and saw the value in introducing virtual reality and this mechanism to the school, but also people seeing it is sharing our vision, which was Victor is the application or the start of adoption in the education sector. So we're already now talking to colleges, employers and training providers about using Victor as a platform to introduce virtual reality into their institutions and corporations.
Yeah, okay, so it's not just for schools then?
No, it's not just for schools now. So Victor is, the current version of Victor is been specifically designed for schools to deliver against that mandate the government has issued. But it's actually the starting point, we believe, for the introduction of virtual reality as a technology into the education on a mass adoption level. Yeah, so it's more about introducing it all right across the board, starting with schools, because the thing about it is once school children start to use technology as part of their curriculum process, it becomes familiar, and it's actually the point where the higher educational institutions, employers, training providers and even the domestic market benefits from that, because they get familiar with the equipment they're using and they want to use it for extended use right throughout the rest of their lives.
Yeah, absolutely. So you've got a lot going on, a lot of developments happening. So generally across all three sectors there, how is business going? You know, are you fully funded going forward? What's the score here?
Yeah, so I mean, when we listed on the IPO, we raised the money we needed to follow our growth predictions. We are already forecasting way ahead of them growth predictions, both in the rollout and distribution of Victor, the platform, but also in terms of the take up for some of our other channels like the Engage platform. So in terms of funding, DevClever is way ahead of where we should be already. Mm-hmm. We're looking forward to that growth really accelerating and continuing over the short-term future.
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense, you know, VR and tech. I love tech, getting into schools. I mean, where I am, my children, for example, I think my eldest son only does computer lessons once a week. I thought, are you kidding? The future is all about, you know, and they're doing spellings on pen and paper. I know that's important, but I do feel schools are a bit behind, you know, with the tech, you know?
Well, so the thing is, Justin, if we go back to, like, when we were at school, you know, 30 years ago or something, you know, 25 years ago, depending on your age, it's actually computers were quite a rare thing, and it took a pivotal application, if you will, which was email and the internet, to then drive that adoption, because it was going to be a structural part of people's future, and that was the reason for schools to then invest in that equipment and put it into their institutions. And once they did that, it then got mass adoption, and that's really what Victor was all about when we started building it years ago. It was to understand what was going to add the value in the current marketplace to make the institutions spend that money out of their already tight budgets because once that technology is in there, that's when we can start using it as a conduit to deliver all that curriculum and training learning in the future.
Yeah, and when you show schools and colleges, you know, your platform and Victor, do they sort of get it straight away?
Straight away, yeah. Because it's been built in collaboration with these institutions, yeah. It's been in live test for 18 months already, a major institution in the UK. It's already been part of an FE Gold Industry Award in the sector. It's been very well considered. So when we introduce it to people, it is a breath of fresh air, and it's exactly what they're looking for.
Yeah, and so the revenue model here, how do you derive revenue from that?
So we charge schools on a SaaS-based model. So schools pay for a license fee. That license fee includes them having a full overview of every one of their students and where they are in terms of their career goals, and also allows them to assess and understand how they can help students stay career-focused right to the point where they make their next step either to a training apprenticeship or onto a further educational pathway. And it's that dashboard and that reporting which really, you know, holds true to the Gatsby benchmarks and the mandate that they need to fulfill to make sure that they're driving that. But then also when we move into colleges or apprenticeship providers or employers, we charge a listing fee for their institutions to display all of their courses so that it's a seamless transition for the young person to then be able to search, see what course they want to go on or see a vacancy they're looking for or look for a company they want to work for in the future, and allows them to advertise them. Their listings in a much more efficient and targeted method, and that's where we take our commercial opportunity. It's for the listing fees, and again, that's on a SaaS-based license fee, and it depends on the size of their organisation.
Yeah, excellent stuff. Okay, well, Chris, one final thing to do, or three final things. If someone's listening right now, likes the sound of what you're doing, but and not yet following your story, could you give them three quick reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page and add you to their watch list, please?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, ultimately, we are, you know, we're a fully funded business. We are ahead of our growth predictions, and we've got lots of exciting news and announcements to come.
Yeah, and let's be honest, you know, AR, VR in education is going to be massive, isn't it?
I mean, it's a no-brainer.
Yeah, and it'll of course be part of every kid's education going forward, I think, because it's growing and growing, and it's here to stay. Marvellous stuff. Chris, thanks for that, and hopefully we'll be catching up in the not-too-distant future. Thanks very much.
Brilliant. Thanks very much.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Alan Green, CEO of Brand Communications. You're all right, Al?
A very good morning from the sunny south coast, Justin. I'm good. How are you?
Yeah, it's good. I'm good, thanks. It is sunny here as well. It's the trouble is, in my office, I don't get a lot of sun. You know, it's got one small window. It's in the garden. I can see the sun and the blue sky. But I can be cold in here and then go outside and it's boiling. But it's nice to have a nice colour. It just lightens everything up, doesn't it? The mood of everything, colours come out, everything is nice.
Yep, indeed. Well, I have an office at the front of the house, and the sun's just moved, of course. Got a big bay window, so I have to put the shutters down and at certain parts of the day, but it's fantastic. It's just lovely. The light at this moment is absolutely fantastic. It's great.
By the way, before we came on, I got the RNS from through the Vox Markets app. By the way, if you use the Vox Markets app, everyone, please, in it, you get value from it. Like someone just said to me, this is a quote here on Twitter. Someone just said, "Love the Vox Markets app. I saw that come out. Bidstack was down because their new shares, they're placing shares, are landing today. They're being emitted today. So there's always a bit of churn. Some places, especially when
it's
12.5 pence they got the shares at, some places may be flipping the stock for a quick profit, which I think is ridiculous because this company could be valued at billions in years to come, but it has that much potential. But, of course, some churn. So the stock was down, but this guy said, "I love the Vox Markets app. I literally saw this RNS come in. I logged in, bought some more shares, and now the price is up on bids." So and he got in there before most. So fast. But yeah, there was two RNSs. So obviously, some directors took part in the placing, not a huge amount. But then they announced an appointment of Lewis Sherlock as vice.
Lewis Sherlock, yeah. Indeed. Yeah,
he'll sniff out the sales vice president of sales. You know,
so he's most recently head of demand platforms for Europe, Middle East, and Africa. Oath, which is Verizon's combination of Yahoo and AOL. So you know that's a pretty major position. And I mean the fact is that all of these industry professionals are coming into Bidstack at this time. It's an incredible endorsement of where the company is going. I will say at this point now, I am now a shareholder in Bidstack too. So, well done, Al.
I think. Yeah, listen, do you know what? Listen, this is why I think this is very significant. Yeah. Now, like I said, Lewis was the most recent head of demand platforms. Now, this is how Bidstack Tech works. Up until now, right? Companies haven't really used native in-game advertising. They've been hardwired in, like FIFA have used it, pretty much sponsors, they've helped out, but those adverts don't change. They're hardwired into the game, they're not linked up to advertising platforms. And there's an issue with that, is because tracking and verification of those ads is very hard. When they're moving adverts, all that, it's very hard to do it. So pop-ups are a lot easier, you can click throughs and all that stuff. It's a lot harder to do. So no one's really capitalized on that massive potential of native in-game advertising. Bidstack has come along. What they've done is they've got its tech now to sort of... And the hard part is this, and it sounds very boring, but when you sell ads online, you need to have... accountability, how many impressions you're getting, what's the trackability of this, you know, and no one's done that in game because it's quite hard. Bidstack are now doing that, and in doing this, they are sort of trailblazers in this area. So they're going to open up, and they've started opening up already with Football Manager and with Dirt Rally. They've opened up a massive revenue stream. FIFA yet, even though Football Manager is massive, FIFA, probably the biggest football game, still hasn't you know, opened up that avenue of commerciality. And Bidstack are the gatekeepers now of this tech that can, you know, show the advertising agencies, okay, this is the impressions you're getting, this trackability you're getting, all this stuff, and click-throughs, they even click through these banners. So Bid are the gatekeeper, pretty much, the gatekeeper to this massive potential of revenue, and DSPs will play a massive... DSPs have come into popularity over the last, I don't know, 5 years, I'm not an expert in advertising, but what I've read is that these programmatic, almost autofill platforms have really come to prominence. Trade Desk being one, of course, and we've got someone from Trade Desk who's now helping out with Bids. But once this is plugged in... Like Lewis here, that's what he did. Lewis was on these DSP platforms. So once... Bidstack get their inventory on more of these DSPs, it will turbocharge the fill on these adverts. Then they'll announce more games. And James came on the podcast and he said, it's a CEO of Bidstack, say, it's a fine line. What we have to do is weigh it up. Because at the moment, we are still messing around with the tech. We are getting it right. We are, you know, in conjunction with the Interactive Advertising Bureau, we're sorting out. We had to create a new category. People couldn't go into DSPs and just buy ads native in-game. The category didn't exist. And to get that category to exist, they had to make sure it had, you know, as high a standards as any other interactive advert on the internet. And that's not been done before.
Well, the auditing, the record keeping has to be right up there with the very best of conventional online advertising tracking processes. And if Bidstack can nail that, this audience is vast. It's absolutely huge. And I think the opportunity to reach gamers who are focused in on what they're doing and also online gaming when you're gaming with, I don't know, 10, 15, 20 other people around the world, you know, all of these groups will have profiles too. So it's an advertiser's dream potentially to reach these people whilst they're in the middle of playing a game and sell them or let them see something relevant that they can then go on and purchase at a later stage. But I mean, the technology is fantastic. And as you say, no one, Bidstack are the gatekeepers to this new world of advertising opportunity. And it is going to be absolutely huge. I'm really excited about it. But I think to go back to what we said right at the start, the fact that these people, these industry professionals and, you know, trailblazers in their own right are actually coming in now to work for Bidstack, coming onto the board, coming into the management team to help set this up. So when the technology gets the green light and gets the tech, all of these people are going to bring their skill sets together. Yeah. Sky's the limit.
I mean, to be honest, they've broken the back of it. I mean, James came on the podcast and said this. He said, listen, he said, work has been done to improve verification and trackability and attract more agencies and publishers. So it's a catch-22. So once they get... They've pretty much done it. He says here in the podcast, he said we've broken the back of it pretty much. There's no off. It's different ways, of course, with moving adverts. He said the viewability looks in it, what it looks like in a video game environment. A racing title is different from a football game. A fantasy game is different from a simulation. So there's no off the shelf answer. And he said, Fran, our CTO guy, Fairplay, they've had to innovate. But he said, what advertisers should look out for, we're doing all that stuff. We've broken the back of it. Now we're building what's going to be a very strong future. So the problem is now, once he gets this, they have games they have to fill inventory on, but these DSPs will help that. So it's almost like as soon as this verification is in there, it's going to go nuts. But like I said, they're on the verge of a massive amount of revenue generation for big, big companies, you know. So and like I said, gaming is massive at the moment. And this is one of the areas, one untapped area of gaming that these people can monetize. And so it's a no-brainer for people like FIFA and all that to just open up to BidStack and say, here we go, you got the tech. We now verify it and all that stuff. Let's go. So it's a matter of time, you know. And the people they're building around them is very impressive. You probably tell I do hold some stock in BidStack.
And so do I now too.
So I do your research. I'm very biased on it, but I do think it's potentially a star stock, a star British tech stock for a long time.
I agree.
Okay. What else are we looking at? What other companies?
Okay, well, AFSEL brought this to my attention some time ago.
I knew it was an AFSEL stock. What is it?
No. Well, it's a company that I took a look at, and I've just been tracking its progress, because so far its progress has just been on the chart at any rate a slippery slope. But it's a company called Eve Sleep.
Did look them up yesterday. I saw AFSEL mention them on thing. I saw they had cash and their market cap. It's not a tech stock. I love tech stocks, and that's one of my filters. But I saw they had cash, and I went to their website. And the cookies tracked me around the website. Then they had these Eve Sleep adverts popping up all over the place.
That's the thing. So the technology is very good. The company came to market, and I think certainly the mattresses have been very well promoted and very well advertised. We're actually looking at changing our mattress ourselves, and Eve Sleep mattresses have been right at the top of the list. And that was before I looked at the company and what the company represented.
What do they do? Why are they so good then? Why have you been looking at these mattresses? What's the big deal about these mattresses?
Well, because it's a special memory foam, and they are just incredibly comfortable. And I know we have friends that have them, and they just rave about them, and they always look very refreshed when they come around. So clearly they're having a very good sleep.
Al, some of the things you get up in your bed on your mattress, I wouldn't want any memory of that going on.
I can tell you right now, I'm not going to go into that at this juncture. But in any event, so I took a look at the company. It IPO'd last year at 85p, and as I say, since then it's just been a slippery slope. Last autumn, the new CEO came in, James Sturrock. He came in to undertake a review of the company. The company's mantra is sleep wellness. So, but by that you can probably gather that, as well as the mattresses, they're expanding into other areas of sleep and bedding and other elements of it. But the company raised 12 million, and that funding was taken up by Neil Woodford, who obviously has had a reputation, and he's got a reputation now that he's trying to recover. So it was taken up. Woodford owns 8 million. The board also subscribed for 1 million. So it's tightly held by institutions and the board with a 20% free float. Early this year, the company appointed a new chief financial officer, Tim Parfitt, who is ex-Loaf. And Loaf, of course, are very well known for sofas and all the rest of it. And indeed, my wife is keeps on trying to persuade me to go back to the Loaf shop in Guildford, where we went to have a look at their sofas last year. Nice shop, nice brand. So again, they're getting a good team of people around them. The company's primarily focused now on UK and Ireland. It was focused on France, but it's stated its intention to draw its horns in and focus on its core markets. And indeed, core market revenues over last year were grew successfully, 25% growth to just under 30 million. Losses were reduced. The company had just under 18 million in the bank at the end of December. Had the same amount at the end of February. So they're not burning cash. They're basically the strategic review has been undertaken, and on the back of that, they're selling into core markets that they estimate are worth some 6 billion per annum, and they're positioning the brand slightly differently. They're expanding the range, as I've already said, and also improving the user or the customer experience. What interested me, though, in the raise was that Channel 4 took shares in lieu of cash to pay for the upcoming ad campaign. And that, to me, it's pretty rare that the TV companies will enter an arrangement like that unless they're pretty sure. But clearly...
Or skint or desperate.
Or skinned or desperate, indeed, yes. Well, there is that. But no. So that's a factor, because that is an indirect endorsement by you know a major TV channel. So yeah, okay. We'll run
but
your
do you
advertising.
Know what? No, the thing is, how do they know Channel 4? There's no investment managers at Channel 4 that know anything about small cap stocks, surely. Because I know brokers who know nothing about stocks and shares. Honestly, there are plenty of brokers who I talk to who know nothing about they're rubbish at stock picking. And I know I know them. I thought, what are you talking about? And they've recommended stocks to me that I can tell straight away is a dog. And so I think
you'll find that the finance director at Channel 4 is a pretty shrewd cookie.
Being a finance director or an accountant even, I know accountants within companies who haven't bought their own stock, and I see it as a good company, and the stock has flown, and they've not bought any. And I'm going, what are you doing? So there's a difference between knowing how to buy small stocks and shares and actually knowing about accountants and figures and all that stuff. Honestly, it's a world's apart. Put it in your parlance, on the world of motorbikes, it's probably the difference between, motocross and actually racing on a track. It's a lot different, you know? It's a lot different.
Well, ironically, probably motocross is a tougher discipline. I've done road racing myself, but my son's also done some off-road too. You have to be a lot fitter. Also, when you come off on the track, which I have done, you tend to slide off and slide down the track, and you've got your leathers and potentially all the rest of it. In motocross, you stop dead, and you tend to break things rather badly. So,
disciplines are completely different. They're both motorbikes, yes, but what I'm saying, being an accountant or financial controller or financial officer is completely different from investing in small cap stocks. Absolutely worlds apart, you know?
That's very true. That's very true. Nonetheless, this is just one element. So when you're collecting...
But they are a sticky holder, probably. Channel 4 will hold the stock, you know, don't they? They'll probably be a good holder, you know?
Well, they will. Absolutely. And also, given where the shares are right now, I mean, the shares, as I say, IPO'd at 85p, they've come down as low as 5.25p, now trading at just on 6p. So market cap of 15 million, it's come all the way back from there. But the company's now fully funded. It's got a great management team in place to help it grow. It's got the support of Channel 4. Broker Peel Hunt have got a price target of 20p on the stock, which obviously is much lower than the IPO price, but nonetheless, you know, that we're looking to broaden the investment portfolio. This company, I think, has got a very good brand. It's well known through its advertising, and I suppose on a personal level, I know friends who have these at mattresses and swear by them. So that to me is a pretty good start. You know, if you know somebody that's using it personally, so that's a third party recommendation. Channel 4 have taken stock, you know, in lieu of cash. So I think could it go low? Yes, of course it could go low. But I think if you're looking on betting on a company that's at the stage where it's turning itself around, I think Eve Sleep is right in that sweet spot at this moment in time. I'm not saying it's going to go blast off to the stars again, but this is a great brand, and I think the company is on the turn, and interesting to see what it does over the next 6 months.
Marvellous stuff, yes. Eve, I did have a quick look about it. I didn't do in-depth research, but I seemed, they had cash and all that stuff, and the chart was bottoming out. And, I like the fact the CFO went from sofas to beds. he's just moved a different room in the house as far as the job is concerned.
maybe they bought Parford in, Tim Parford in, to help them expand the range. And that's what it says to me. And Loaf, of course, are a very successful brand for sofas in their own right. Very upmarket, very chic.
But I like the fact when they approached him, he probably said, "Well, yes, you know what? I like beds because I quite like sofas. I do like to lie down on comfortable items of furniture in the house. So I can't say I can see my transition to bedding from sofas be quite a nice smooth one." I haven't even moved out of the house. I'm still in the house. I'm just going to another room.
Still in the house. Just walked up the stairs. Yeah,
exactly. Marvelous. Anything else, Al, going on?
Yeah, indeed. We spoke about one of Aidan Bishop's companies last week. That's Big Dish, of course. And he's also chairman of a mining company, which I've been taking a look at. And the company is called Bluebird Merchant Ventures. BMV is the epic code. It's a tiny miner. It's 4.9 million market cap. Shares have been as high as 3.3p on the year, as low as 1.7p. Currently trading at 2.3 pence. So the company's focused in South Korea. It's focused on gold mines in South Korea. The company's run by Colin Patterson, who's got over 40 years' experience in the mining industry. He was executive chairman of a Philippine listed gold company, Apex Mining, and he's basically very well known in his field. And of course, Aidan, as we know from Big Dish, is the chairman there. So the company has two key gold mines in South Korea. The company are looking at. There's the Ko Chang mine, and also the Gabong mine, which the company has applied for a development permit. And on April 25th, the company said that the South Korean government were progressing these applications much, much faster than expected. And Colin Patterson said, to the effect, in my history, in mining, I've never seen mining applications progress at this rate or not. So Ko Chang has an indicated inferred resource of 113,200 ounces of gold. Now that's it's interesting because the Korean Resources Corporation, which is a government-owned body, independently went into Ko Chang mine and sampled and took their own samples of the mine after Bluebird Merchant Ventures had done this. And the samples came back with a slightly lower indicated inferred resource, 130,000 ounces, compared to Bluebird Merchant's estimates of 116,000 ounces. But the grams per ton of gold, Bluebird Merchant had down 5.9 grams per ton. The South Korean Resources Corporation has 6.5 grams per ton. And also the mines contain silver. Bluebird Merchant estimated 31 grams per ton. South Korean Resources Corporation estimated just under 36 grams per ton, which is so KRC are basically saying that the standard of inferred and indicated resources are of a higher standard, although there's slightly less of it. So, but again, third party validation of the potential of the Kuchar mine. So, in short, we've got two mining assets in South Korea. The company is trading at 4.9 million sterling at the moment, so there's no upside at all in there. It raised just under $500,000 in March, 2.25p at the current level. So we're at the raised price, which is fine, and these applications are progressing. So if you were to take a punt on a small mining company that looks as though it's in a very good position to to progress these applications and go to the next phase, then Bluebird Motion Ventures could be the company. Also, from a technical standpoint, if you look at the chart, you'll see the company hit a low at the end of last year, and then it basically gained and put on weight during February to go up to just under 3p, came back, and it's formed a higher low. So I quite like the look of the chart, and you know, when you've got the chart and the fundamentals coming together like this, okay, there's a risk involved, but you know, there could be some good upside on offer here.
Marvellous stuff. That's BMV, of course, and it's gold, South Korea. So it is South Korea, isn't it? It's not North Korea, don't worry.
Yeah, it's most definitely South Korea. Yeah,
yeah. You don't have to fight Fat Boy Kim to get involved in that area. There, it's not a problem.
Not at all. So, although if it's on the border and some of the tunnels go underneath, there might be one of those nasty automatic machine guns waiting for you if you walk too far down the tunnel. But I'm sure it's nowhere near.
Did you see him recently when he got off his train? He looked exactly like Odd Job from the James Bond films. He had a big hat on like Odd Job, and I think he must have been a James Bond fan, a film fan. But anyway. Marvellous stuff, Al. Thanks for that, fella, and we'll catch up next week.
Indeed. Thanks, Jess. Speak next week.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Darren Sinden, market analyst at Pepperstone. You all right, Darren?
Yeah, morning, Justin. Very well, thank you. And yourself?
Yeah, good, thanks. Are people not aware of Pepperstone? What is it then? Just tell us for people who know them.
Well, Pepperstone is one of the world's largest foreign exchange and CFD brokers. It's headquartered in Australia, but we have a presence here in Europe. We're in London, and we're also applying for a license in Germany under BaFin. So we're a big name in Asia Pacific and growing elsewhere around the world. We've been in the UK and active in the UK for just coming up for 2 years. It'll be 2 years in August since we went fully live in the UK and Europe. So we're becoming more well known, and we're going to try and increase our brand presence and our market recognition and our volumes, of course, as we move forward from here.
Yeah, well, do you know what? I did check out. What I think is, you know, the internet, a revolution in advertising, wasn't it? You know, and I, because I'm from radio background, and radio is very much broadcasting. So essentially, what happens is, if you advertise on a commercial radio station and say it's a car sales as advertising, it's a lot of wasted airtime there, because you are advertising to say everyone listening, but only say 1% or less than that are probably looking for a car, you know, so it's pointless really. But when the internet came along, it's very clever because it's a lot more targeted. They can target you on where you are, what you're looking for. And I looked your website up, and I thought, oh, let's look at what they do there at Pepperstone. And now your ads have been following me around the internet, you know, because of cookies. So it's very effective, isn't it, you know?
Well, we do pride ourselves on our use of technology and our marketing and becoming, you know, and getting the most out of our marketing for our marketing dollar spend, shall we say. So I think our marketing department will think that's a job well done if you're noticing our branding everywhere you go now.
Yeah, and do you know what? Just thinking about radio then, why radio suffered a little bit over the years. I mean, I know commercial radio, the marketplace in the UK, they've basically wiped out all local stations, and now they're centralising it. Say, so they'll have a morning and drive time DJs. They'll have because essentially the advertising spend isn't there anymore because it's been split up across internet and new media. But I think in time, radio can catch up, so because when you get 5G coming out, there's less latency in 5G, and so basically you have geo sort of location switched on, so you can I assume the tech should be there when the internet of things kicks in and the cars are all connected. They can tell you actually where you are, and they can advertise to you more accurately. So radio's taking a while to catch up, but it will get there with the internet of things and 5G, you know.
I think that's right, Justin, and what they call edge of the network processing, which is one of those buzzwords you read, but basically having things done locally rather than necessarily, you know, having to flash back to big servers. And once that kind of technology is here, then yes, you can imagine walking down a street and being recognised through your 5G phone, and maybe a billboard posting an advert that's peculiar to you or to half a dozen of people on that street who've got similar tastes to you. So you can well imagine that, and I imagine as well, subject to the regulatory requirements, Pepperstone will try and be at the forefront of that advertising as well. So there we go.
Yeah, well, do you know what? I don't know if you said this, but a while back, about a few weeks back, or a month back, I went to Cardiff to visit the parents, and we went out to see a rugby game with the kids and all that. And they went to Wagamama, and I don't think he even logged in. I don't think I did anything. My father paid for the meal kindly. Went home a day later, got an email from Wagamama. How was your experience? What? That was crazy, because apparently I'd previously logged on to the cloud that they use. And when you do that, you say, you select, I accept that they were sent the email messages. But I didn't even open my phone in the restaurant, I think. So that was a bit scary, them following me around in real life, you know. So anyway, here we go. Let's get into some macro news then, Daz. So first and foremost, we've got to talk about the ramping up of trade tensions of Trump and up in the thing, and then Beijing coming back at them. But they put a delay on it, haven't they, Beijing?
Yeah, I mean, my headline this morning here is trade talks in tatters, and I think that's probably a fair description. Obviously, we saw, there was a hope that a deal could be done finally on Friday, which didn't materialise. And even then, the markets thought that the two parties had left on good terms, shall we say. But of course, it deteriorated dramatically over the weekend. The US ramped up the tariffs on that existing group of Chinese goods that were subject to tariffs, another 15% on top, I believe, I'm right in saying, of charges there. And then over the weekend, as you say, the Chinese slapped tariffs on $60 billion worth of US imports into China. And now Mr. Trump is considering slapping tariffs on the balance of Chinese goods that come into the US, roughly $300 billion worth of Chinese imports. So there's been talk that the Chinese are selling off US treasuries, and so it's become a game of tit-for-tat retaliation. Rather than progressing towards an agreement, it looks very much like the two sides are sailing further and further away from each other. And it also transpires that the Americans might now be turning their sights to the EU through tariffs on autos and parts. So at the minute, the EU has an exemption on those goods, but that expires on the 18th of May, and there's not an absolute cast iron guarantee that the US will continue with that waiver. So, talks are fair with the Chinese, and maybe the EU's next in the firing line. And that has really unsettled the markets. And just to some background there, if you hadn't seen it already, the EU Trade Commissioner, a Swedish lady called Malmström, has already said that she wouldn't stand for that, and that the EU would retaliate, and that they've drawn up a list of $20 billion worth of US imports into Europe that they would immediately put tariffs on if the Americans don't extend that waiver on autos. So it's becoming increasingly fraught. Other parties are being dragged in, and of course lots and lots of other countries that aren't directly involved in these negotiations are involved, because they're on the periphery of the supply chain, whether they're component suppliers of raw materials, or just provide services, or even if you're a port on the way through, and ships stop off to drop small amounts of cargo there, you could see that disappear too if Asia US trade goes into decline, if the Chinese and the Americans can't resolve their issues. So that's what's really concerning the market. It's not just the headline things, it's the knock-on effect.
Yeah, and do you know what? I do think they'll come to an agreement. Do you? I mean, they've got to. Like I said, like you were saying there, the alternative is bad for both sides, even though it's probably worse for China than US. It's better to do a deal, isn't it?
I think so. I mean, it's not to say I don't think the Chinese need to bend in the breeze and renegotiate some of the trade terms they've got with the US, but yes, we talk about globalization, and this is the perfect example of it. There aren't really Chinese or American products anymore, or very few. They're pretty much global products that might have a bias towards China or the US or another domicile. And the supply chains and the logistics run through so many different countries, so many different component parts. Tariffs are such a blunt measure that, not having a trade agreement, it's almost unthinkable. That said, Donald Trump clearly doesn't see it like that. He's got some very odd ideas about who will end up actually paying these extra tariffs that he's levied on Chinese goods. He seems to think that the Chinese will ultimately pay, although clearly the reality is it's US companies and their customers that will end up wearing the brunt of any price rises that result. So It's very tricky. They're all set to, all world leaders are set to meet, aren't they, later in June at the G20. And there's a chance that Presidents Trump and Xi of China could catch up there. So we're talking about really a month away, perhaps before we make any real progress from here. But just thinking about how far the sides are apart, perhaps the best we could hope for from a meeting of those two is an agreement to continue trade negotiations and maybe kicking the can down the road into the autumn, sort of post the Labor Day holiday in the States, so early part of September onwards. But we'll have to wait and see. In the meantime, of course, the markets finally took fright from this yesterday. The US equities tried to rally into the close on Friday and did very well. But yesterday we saw probably a fair reflection of how people are thinking about what the trade war could mean. And we saw, a very sharp sell-off in US equities, the Dow, the S&P 500 and the NASDAQ all declining sharply. Something of a rebound this morning. I mean, just looking at my feeds here, the Dow's rallied roughly 100 points from yesterday's close. The S&P's up 12 and the NASDAQ's bounced back 45. So there's a bounce, but it's a bit half-hearted compared to the losses. Mm-hmm. And one thing that caught my eye, and I mentioned in my early morning video, was this idea that not only have equities sold off, but when we look at, I'm talking about US equities here, but when we look further forward to Q2 earnings, we've seen that earnings expectations have continued to decline. Now, obviously, we're not quite finished with Q1 earnings in the US, although 90% of S&P 500 companies have reported so far. But markets are forward-looking, and they are looking now into mid-July to see what might be the net upshot of this sort of trade debacle, shall we say. Just as a bit of background, I understand in aggregate Q1 19 earnings in the States have declined by 0.5% overall, and that's the first earnings per share decline that we've seen in the S&P 500 since the second quarter of 2016. So the forecast is pretty better than we were expecting, but still it's a decline. And at the moment, the expectation for Q2 earnings is for a modest bounce back with earnings growth of just 0.52%. But I suspect that we might see further revisions to those earnings forecasts between now and then. Mm-hmm. American company reports are always a bit gamed. They like to sort of under promise and over deliver, so they're rarely that effusive about the quarter ahead, shall we say. And they might say some bullish things, but they tend to downplay it and then hope that they can breeze past analysts' expectations. But that's obviously not been the case so much in this quarter, and now I suspect, as I say, that the suspicion is that won't be the case in Q2 either. So
is it down to them? I mean, China, like you said, they put that backstop, that deadline, haven't they? June, is it June the 1st, is that right?
I think that's what they're suggesting.
So yes. Hopefully they're going to get it through before. I mean, I think it's a nice little deadline there to sort of work towards, because they were sounding in the morning reports, as you say, there's certain sounds of a bit more optimism, saying a trade deal can still get done and all that stuff. But I think whatever Chinese are doing, where they're dragging their feet or going back on deals, hopefully this will give them a kick up the backside and say, come on, move on with it, and we'll move forward. So hopefully it's not good for any of them, and it's not good for the world, is it?
No, it's not. I mean, you only had to look at a couple of issues yesterday, individual stocks, The way that Apple fared yesterday was down 5% at one point. A lot of other tech names were feeling the pain too, and it's just not good for sentiment. We talked, didn't we, last week about how Uber might be a barometer for sentiment for the US equity market, and of course it finally traded on Friday, traded lower then, and traded lower again yesterday. So the IPO price was clearly the top, mm-hmm. At least for now. And I think that might be one to watch. If sentiment turns in Uber and they start heading back up to and through that IPO price, then maybe all's right with the world again as far as US equity is concerned. But until that happens, I think, I don't use that as a sole indicator, but I think I'd tread cautiously while they're underwater.
Yeah, cool. Okay, anything else? You mentioned Vodafone has cut their dividend. I mean, it's been a dreadful performing share, isn't it, for the last couple of years, isn't it? I
think absolutely, really poor performer. I think I've seen statistics that they're over down by about 30% in not that long a time metric. But I mean, it was rumoured in the weekend press that that they would potentially cut the dividend, and they've done that today. They've slashed it. I think that's fair. They were paying 15, just over 15 euro cents, and they've cut that dividend to 9 euro cents, and that's, you know, well, it's not quite halved, is it? But it's well on its way to do that. I mean, they make a case for why they're doing it. They say they're doing it to try and pay down their debt burden and to, you know, find the funds to invest in 5G. But what, I mean, there are 2 points to make here. First of all, I think the company's got to look long and hard about whether it's got the right product mix and asset mix in its business. It's spent a lot of money buying cable assets off of Liberty Global in Europe last year, and that's probably perhaps why it's got itself into a bit of a pickle over debt. Given that they now want to invest in 5G, which if it works properly will probably negate the need for a cable connection, it does over time. It does make you wonder why they bought those assets. I'm sure they had their reasons for doing it. Secondly, not stock specific, it just shows you how fragile some of these stocks are as far as the income that they produce and the dividend yields that are available. It's not the first dividend cut we've seen over the last year from major companies. And I think life's going to become increasingly hard for dividend investors who are looking for not just high yields, because you can find a high yield. It's a question of whether that yield can be maintained and whether the company can afford to pay that down. So you need to look at things like the payout ratio and the dividend cover when you're looking at dividend investing or income investing generally. And as I say, I think those opportunities are going to become fewer and farther between, particularly if you've got one of these ethical or sustainable bents on your portfolio. Because if you're excluding perhaps the likes of Royal Dutch Shell and BP, for example, if you don't like the idea of fossil fuels, it's very hard to you know, reproduce that income. And I saw an article recently where fund managers were calling for Shell and BP to pack up and return their money to shareholders, you know, to stop producing fossil fuels and return the money to shareholders. Now, that's not very likely, is it? But in any circumstances. But I just wonder where those fund managers thought that they could replace the dividend income that they receive from those companies. And when you think how important the role of reinvestment in dividends has been over the years in terms of producing long-term returns as well, even if you don't explicitly look for the income but you reinvest it, it really does help towards long-term capital growth. So you know, it's not a massive issue for the moment. They're still paying a dividend at Vodafone, and there are other opportunities elsewhere. But as I say, I don't think we can carry on taking that for granted. It also struck me as very interesting that Vodafone should be concerned about debt levels in a climate where interest rates are still relatively low. So maybe they've got heart and eye to the future, thinking that low rates are not here to stay forever, and that they could indeed start to crank up in the medium term.
But I can't believe a fund manager said that. I mean, I'm not into any oil and gas stocks anyway, but I mean, there's still a huge amount of need for oil and gas, isn't there? And we're way off from even transitioning anywhere near. I mean, I think about it's something like only 3% of the world's cars are electric vehicles. So, you know, it's a massive amount still need, you know, oil and gas. And that's just one side of it. I mean, there's also oil and gas used for everything, like plastics and all that stuff. So it's a massive industry still, yeah.
Oh, absolutely. But, they're not alone. I mean, the guys that run the Norwegian Sovereign Wealth Fund, one of the biggest funds in the world, they've basically decided they're not going to invest any more money in fossil fuels, and they'll be reducing their holdings in the sector, which is the height of irony, really, since the vast majority of the money that's in the fund in the first place comes from, you know, the abundance of natural gas and oil.
Yeah, but they pulled out of companies, didn't they, solely invested in oil and gas. So they didn't pull out from the big guys like Shell, who have interests in clean energy and renewables and all that stuff.
They've left themselves a bit of wiggle room. But still, it does strike of the pot calling the kettle black to some extent. Yeah. But there we are. That's their new methodology, and you know, I'm sure over time they will try and scale back further. That's their decision. They run the money, but it just shows that that trend is in the marketplace. And you can never say never to anything. But so Vodafone's dividend down, and in fact the stock's actually rallied on the news. So it's not all bad. But having sold off yesterday, but there we go. And the last thing, Justin, I had on my list here was, in case you guys hadn't heard this, how good the UK employment data was. Falling to unemployment falls to another record. 44 years low, 1974, the period between the autumn and Christmas. It was the last time we had unemployment at this low level. Wages haven't grown quite so strongly as you might expect, but that's not peculiar to the UK. I mean, there are tight labour markets here in the UK and in countries such as the US, and wages just aren't growing. I think it's the nature of the beast that labour has lost to some extent, and I mean that in the broadest sense, its bargaining power over wages, less unionisation, and less employers feel that they don't need to pay for many jobs, particularly high salaries. Of course, if we keep cranking down the unemployment rate like this, that may change, because there won't actually be anybody to fill the jobs that are outstanding. And that's the situation they're very much heading to in the States, where there are more jobs available now than there are adult workers to fill them.
A good case for automation then, isn't it?
Well, it is. And I noted yesterday that Amazon is now starting to replace some people in its pick and pack operations in the US, and particularly on the packing side, with robots. And that's always been my benchmark, really. When people in that sort of relatively lowly paid unskilled job of no offence to the people that do it, but picking things off a shelf and putting them in a trolley, when they start to be replaced by the machines, then we know that we're on the foothills of the full rollout to automation. And that is happening now in the States, despite apparently the US being one of the slowest adopters of automation in the developed world. I've seen stats about that, and they come mid-table at best, and in some cases very low down the table. So but that's starting to change, and I think that's going to become more and more of a factor in all of our lives.
Marvellous stuff, Daz, thanks for that, and we'll catch up next week, fella.
Thank you, Justin. A pleasure as always.
Okay, it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. They are at five. Union Jack All, UJO. Of course, I talked to David Bramall yesterday on the podcast because their finals released. At four, Bidstack Group. An amazing bit of news coming out again. They are assembling the Avengers of gaming and advertising, I think. And I talked about that with, of course, Alan today. At three, Eve Sleep, which Alan talked about, actually, on the podcast. EVE's ticker there. At two, Integumin, down 4.3%, but I got a lot of good feedback from the investor meeting yesterday. People seem to be there, and Jerry did a good job. At two, Iofina, it's down 27%. IOF is ticker there. That's been around for a while. Okay, top five most liked RNSs as follows. At five, Sunrise Resources, new Pearl Project exploration permit approval. At four, Strategic Minerals, financial results for the year ended 31st December 2018. At three, New Pharma, final results. At two, Bidstack, directors, PDM shareholders. And at one, Bidstack Group appointment of Vice President of Sales, of course. Cover that with Alan. That's it for the podcast. And like I said, the Vox Markets app, it's free to use, but if you get any value from it, please give us some feedback at the App Store where you downloaded it from, Android or iPhone. Thanks so much. Much appreciated.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.